a prophet, then go where he cannot find us.
Bobo?
Yes? A smile sits up in the bath. His dark hand appears on the porcelain beside my arm, but he does not speak. What is it, Esmail?
Aren't we being thugs, hurting that woman for her house?
My face grows immediately warm.
No, we have done nothing wrong, nothing.
Not comperani.
My wife's face turns upward from the floor, a pale shape in the darkness.
Your son speaks only truth. You should have never kept this girl's home. You have done this to us.
Chafisho, shut up!
I stand, but I have no place to move. I look down at the floor and into the bath, at the shadows that are my wife and son.
Do you think I do all this for me?
I could live in the street.
I do this for you, Esmail, because I am your father and you will take what I give you. Do you think that woman out there is blameless? This Jende who comes here drunk to die? Do you think she did nothing to help her lose her own home? It is I who have done nothing. I simply purchased a property that can give my son a future. Is it I who has locked us in this toilet? Is it I who forced us from our old life? Nadi, tell to me. What is it I have done except provide for my family? I think of nothing else, ever, ever, Nadere. Only this. Only you. So close your mouths, both of you. You will show me respect or what, Berani?
My wife stands quickly, and I hear her fast breath, smell in it the old tea and obgusht.
Will you call Savak? Tell to him we are not respectful? Do not throw these stones at us. They are lies. You want this home for you. You! You could never live in the street because there no one would respect you, Berani. And you need everyone to respect you. Even strangers must respect you. Here your uniform means nothing and this is killing you. Do not talk to me of this when it is you who made us spend all our money to impress people we do not know. For Saraya, yes, for her. But you, but I nothing. I want only my children to be happy, Berani. I do not care of anything else.
Mamon, Bobo, please, don't fight. Please, don't make noise.
Esmail is standing in the bath, his tall body only darkness against the tile wall beneath the panjar. His voice is high with fear, and I feel my Rafiq Purat forced to watch his own son stand against such a wall. My anger leaves me as quickly as water from a broken urn. Yes, Juna. You are right. We must keep our heads. Lie down and rest.
I can't, Baba. What are you going to do?
Shh! Farsi only, I whisper. Lie down.
I sit upon the bath's edge while my son carefully rests his feet once again on the wall of faucets and knobs. Behind me, Nadere seats herself upon the closed toilet and exhales loudly. She rests her face in her hands, and I am certain she has brought on one of her headaches, but for the moment I do not care.
Baba?
Junam,
were you a Savaki?
Of course not. You know I was not. Please do not even think this.
But you knew them, right?
Yes, I knew some of those men.
Did you meet them at Shahenshah's palace?
No, my son. I again see Purat's nephew Bijan as we sat around the vodka and masvachiar, the reflection of firelight in his drunk eyes, eyes as dark and indifferent as a dog's.
You know Saraya's new brother-in-law, Baba?
Yes.
He said it was Savak's fault we got kicked out of our country because they killed too many people. Is that true?
I do not know, Esmail. Rest. Tomorrow we must have our energy, our concentration.
What are we going to do?
I breathe deeply, allowing my answer to come with my breath. We pretend that man is in charge of the situation. That is what we do. We let him think this, and when he is not looking, we defeat him.
How?
Courage. He is attempting to frighten us away, but we will not be frightened, will we, Junam? I'm not scared. Esmail folds his arms in front of him.
Good, good.
But Pesaram, my son, tomorrow I want you to appear frightened. I want you to do whatever that man tells to you.
Why?
I do not tell my son my primary reason, that I fear my child may attempt something youthful and heroic that may provoke Burdon to a rash action. Because if he thinks he has frightened us, he may feel secure to leave us alone.
You mean he thinks we'll be too scared to try anything even when he's gone?
Yes, that's right.
No problem, Baba John.
I kiss my son on his head. His hair smells of the sea. Good night, my son. I sit once more upon the floor beside the bath. Esmail is quiet a few moments. Nadere lies silently down upon her towels.
Baba?
Shh! Sleep. Rest.
Soraya's brother-in-law said the Shah ordered Savak to kill families, the kids too, just because the father read certain books.
Soraya's brother-in-law is stupid. He knows nothing. Now please, sleep.
But he also said,
Sake Bosh, sleep.
Okay, Baba. Good night.
Outdoors the night is still, and I do not know if the fog has disappeared or not. But I suspect it has not. No sounds of any kind come through the panjar, not the call of a bird, not the working of an insect, not the fall of a dead pine twig in the woodland across the street, not even the bark of a dog down the hill in the village, or the passing of a lone automobile. And so I of course imagine the entire land covered in a thick fog blanket, one that hides and protects and disguises, one that allows lies to live on untested. How can I tell to my son I have heard dozens of these stories as well? How can I tell to him that I drank vodka with a Savaki at the Purat's home? How can I tell to Esmail that I am sorry for yelling at him without my voice betraying this heat in my face, this feeling in my blood, that if it was only me in this locked toilet and not my wife and son, then I would finally be receiving what I deserved, that the time had come for Colonel Masood Amir Behrani to stand at the wall, to stand at full attention and face his accusers. Lester pulled into the parking compound behind the Hall of Justice, just as Lieutenant Alvarez was locking his jeep, his short hair combed back wet from his post-run shower, his briefcase hanging against his ironed pant leg. Lester parked out of sight in the motor pool between two K-9 cruisers and waited for Alvarez to go inside. It was only a 7:45, 15 minutes before internal affairs opened, and Lester wanted to give the lieutenant time to hear his voicemail, to get Lester's message from last night. He checked himself in the rearview mirror. His own hair was wet from the Purissima spring at the fish camp, and he'd nicked his chin, shaving without a mirror. He'd pushed a folded bit of toilet paper against it to catch the blood, and now it was a dry red speck on his face. His eyes were small and bloodshot from no sleep. There was a light scratch on his nose from the backyard hedge he'd shouldered his way through last night, and the slacks he'd pulled from his suitcase needed ironing, though the blue short-sleeved polo shirt he wore looked all right. Anyway, it didn't matter. This slightly disheveled look might even help his story, which was the truth. My wife and I are having serious problems, Lieutenant. I just couldn't get away, sir. Though Lester still didn't know what he was going to say about the colonel. Just before dawn this morning, while Kathy and his prisoner slept, he sat at her kitchen counter and wrote, "Dearest Kathy, I know this all looks very dramatic and wrong, but the way it all came together seems inevitable now. I think they're finally going to clear out. Please do not let them out until I get back, and don't let them know I'm not in the house. I have to go into Redwood City. Be back by 9. You should drink plenty of water and juice. See you then. Les. If you need to relieve yourself, I recommend the backyard." Lester had folded the paper once. On the back was Persian handwriting, and he crossed it out and wrote Kathy's name in capital letters. He wondered if he'd written too little about what she tried to do to herself last night. If his directions on what she should drink would look like he was afraid to go any deeper than that. When the truth was, he wanted to know more now than he ever had. He wanted to go so deeply inside her, he would hardly even be him anymore. After his last talk with the colonel through the bathroom door, Lester had spent the rest of the night in a chair by Kathy's bed. Her hair was fanned out on the pillow, and in the lamplight, her color was better. There was more pink in her cheeks, her lips didn't seem as dark, and all he wanted to do was kiss them, to taste again her tongue and teeth, to be inside her completely, all of him. But first, there was having to slip himself free of his entanglement with this Iranian colonel and his family, coming up with something credible this morning for Alvarez, though the last thing Lester felt comfortable doing was leaving this house. What if Kathy woke and stumbled to the bathroom without reading the note, and then let them all out? Or what if she kept them all locked up, but the colonel realized Lester and his gun were no longer in the house? Would he encourage the family to start screaming for help? But what was the alternative? Lester had disobeyed a direct order from an LT in Internal Affairs, then left a message on his machine saying he'd be in his office first thing this morning to explain everything. If Lester didn't show again, then he would absolutely lose all credibility and any chance to talk away his incident with the colonel. What's more, Alvarez, who got paid to have a nose for worst-case scenarios, could want to speak with the colonel again, could call him, or even send out a patrol car. Lester left Kathy's note on the bedside table near his empty teacup, then thought better of it, and slid half of it into the door casing at what he hoped was her eye level. He thought about kissing her cheek or forehead, but he didn't want to wake her. So much had happened since they last spoke. It would take too long for them to get things into some kind of even understanding before he could leave. He walked back down the carpeted hall, pressed his ear to the bathroom door, and heard one of them snoring, a light nasal snore that left him feeling he might pull off leaving after all. He stuck his pistol down the front of his pants, covered it with his shirt, and left the house for the darkness outside. He urinated in the woods across the street. A fog hovered among the black trees, and the sky already was beginning to lighten. He put his car in neutral, left his door open, and pushed until the Toyota was off the soft shoulder and the hill started to take it, and he hopped in and coasted silently down toward the sea. Now the sun was bright off the chain-link fence around the motor pool, and Lester glanced at his watch. 5 more minutes and he'd go in. And he was going to have to tell the truth. If he lied, he would force Alvarez to call or even visit the Iranian for a follow-up interview. He imagined the Behrani family awake now, having to urinate in each other's presence, the mother too, a woman from a culture that demanded women cover themselves from face to foot. He pictured the colonel knocking on the door, prepared to do what he must. If Kathy was still asleep and no one answered, would he assume Lester was too, and then tell his family they would all have to wait a bit longer? Or would he hear the silence and think the house was empty and begin making noise? There had to be a better way to proceed, but right now Lester didn't know what it was, only that there was quite a bit he hadn't done as well as he could. He thought about Bethany and Nate, how sometime today he was going to have to get them alone for a talk. Maybe early tonight he'd take them out for hamburgers and chocolate shakes at a fast food shack on the beach somewhere. He imagined Kathy with them too, but then he let that one go. His daughter and son wouldn't be ready for that for a while, and the truth was he wasn't quite ready for it either. With any luck, Kathy would be moving back into her place at dusk anyway, and he thought of Bethany one sundown when she was 4 and they were all at the beach. Carol was nursing Nate, and Bethany sat next to him in the sand, her Star Wars towel around her shoulders. She turned to him and asked where the new sons come from.
The new sons?
What do you mean, sweetie?
The new one that comes out every morning, Daddy.
Honey, there's just one son. No, 'cause look, Daddy, the ocean's putting that one out. See? It's getting all wet. They all do, Daddy. Didn't you know that? He'd laughed and pulled her onto his lap, hugged her to him, and kissed her wet, sandy hair until his lips started to feel numb. A truck horn sounded in the traffic out on Broadway, and Lester got out of the Toyota and locked it. His pistol was under the passenger seat, and he wished he'd taken his holster from Kathy's Bonneville at dawn. He thought about how she might feel when she woke. Would the pills and his gun become something from a faraway drunkenness she wouldn't even need to think about anymore? He walked across the sunlit lot for the shaded doors at the back of the Hall of Justice, and he had to squint in the light, his head aching slightly at the eyebrows, his legs two long sandbags underneath him. His mouth was dry, and he planned on getting a cold Coke from the machines around the corner from the elevators. He took a deep breath and told himself just to speak the truth about Monday night, not a word about last night, but admit everything about Monday. His jacket was positively trouble-free. Alvarez might even let it all go with an oral reprimand. "Hey, Les!" It came from behind him, but Lester stepped into the shade of the building before he turned around. It was Doug, hopping out of his patrol car, leaving the engine running. His uniform was stretched tight at the shoulders and across the chest, and his forearms looked, as always, impossibly thick. He was chewing gum, something he always did on patrol, never any other time. He'd gotten a haircut, his brown hair shorter than Alvarez's, and Lester could see his scalp glisten in the sunlight just before Doug stepped up into the shade, saying, "I thought you were off. Left a book in my locker. Why aren't you out on patrol?" Doug shook his head, said he had to clean up two arrest reports from yesterday. He looked straight into Lester's face and began to chew his gum with his mouth closed, as if chewing gum was a slightly indecent thing to be doing, under the circumstances. "Barbara went over to see Carol last night. She stayed pretty late." "Yeah?" Lester thought he knew where this was going, and he didn't like it. He also wanted to hurry inside, get his appointment over with, and get back on the freeway heading north. "Carol wanted us both to come over. But tell you the truth, Les, I didn't feel like hearing you get shit-canned all night. You look like crap, by the way. Sleep at the camp last night?" "We're there for now." Lester looked away and over the chain-link fence to the old courthouse on the other side of the street. Its huge stained-glass dome looked cool and composed under the sun. "We still, huh?" "That's right, Doug." "Listen, I know we've already done this little dance, but are you real clear on what you're doing?" Real clear. Doug used that kind of language all the time, a vestige of all the inner healing weekend workshops he took with Barbara. Doug put his hand on Lester's shoulder, a warm, calloused paw. "'Cause you know you're throwing it all away, right, man? All those years between you two, you're trashing them. You do know that." Lester took in Doug's face, his friend's forehead all ridged with concern, his eyes blue and bright and earnest as he'd ever seen them. But naive, too. It's what Lester had always liked and disliked about him. "I don't look at it that way." Lester turned to open one of the doors, letting Doug's hand fall away. He could feel the echo of his heart in his veins, and he was thirstier than ever. "I appreciate you looking out for me, Doug, but tell you what, you go patrol your territory, and I'll patrol mine. Okay, man?" Lester turned and walked into the air-conditioned Hall of Justice. Three lawyers in dark suits stood at the elevators with their briefcases and paperwork. He glanced at his watch and decided to skip the Coke. Maybe Alvarez would offer him coffee or water. He stood and waited, his hands crossed in front of him, his eyes on the polished brass elevator doors. He could see his reflection there, taller than the lawyers, but divided by the center line where the doors met. Then the tone sounded, the doors began to part, and as Lester moved forward, he watched his own image spread out from the middle, then disappear.
There was just what was in front of me, things I knew but didn't. An empty chair facing the side of my bed, an open door with a brass-plated knob, the knob of all the doors of all the rooms I'd ever lived in, lamplight across the blanket that covered me completely, even my arms. It looked like wool, as brown and purple as eggplant, and I was too warm under it, but I didn't move. My throat was dry and sore, and my face and head felt flat, part of the pillow underneath. I was sweating. I could taste the salt in my throat, and I was waiting for my mother to walk through the doorway to get me up for the bus ride to school. But this is where I lay and sometimes watch Nick walk in from the bathroom. He'd come back naked or wrapped in a towel, his love handles hidden beneath the terry cloth. Then he'd dress quietly in front of the closet so he wouldn't wake me, stepping into his underwear, tucking his bobbing penis under the waistband, pulling on his suit pants, and leaving them unbuttoned and unzipped until he found the right shirt. I'd sit up and light a cigarette, smoke it, and watch him put on the costume he couldn't wait to shed each night when he came home to eat too much, then smoke too much while he played bass in his practice room till I made him come watch TV with me, or make love. Now I heard muffled voices coming from behind a wall, in ancient language, the colonel's and then his wife's, and I sat up in their brass bed in a robe I didn't remember putting on. I held it closed at my throat, though I was sweating and felt suddenly queasy. The window shade was pulled, but a crack of white sunlight showed on one side of the heavy curtains I never hung. I remembered kiwi fruit sliced in half on a tray of tea, the colonel's wife on her knees beside me holding my forehead. I swung the blanket and sheet away and sat up for my clothes, but there was just the empty chair. I closed my eyes and took a deep breath, smelled tea. My mouth was so dry and it tasted terrible, and I didn't want to step out of this room. I heard the front screen door open and shut, and I got up to close the bedroom door, but Lester walked in from the hallway and looked at me like he wasn't sure it was really me. Then he hugged me, pulling me to him, his neck wet with sweat. I put my arms around him and felt the gun handle sticking out the back of his pants, remembered my cupped hands under the faucet in the fluorescent light. Lester was hugging me hard, turning from side to side. I couldn't breathe. I pushed myself away from him and stood there looking at him. His eyes were small and bloodshot, and there was a scratch on his nose, a small cut on his chin, his mustache crooked as ever. He stood so still, his long arms hanging there, that gun hidden behind him. He was every boy I had ever fallen for, lean and dark and over the edge, and I started to cry, covering my mouth and putting my hand out so he wouldn't step any closer. I sat down on the bed and let it come. Lester sat on the edge of the chair in front of me and rested both hands on my knees. They were big, his fingers so long I felt like a little girl, and I didn't know if this was a good feeling or not. Then he got up and left the room, came back with tissues. I wiped my eyes and blew my nose. I couldn't look at him, and I didn't want him looking at me. My bare feet looked blurred against the carpet, my toenails chipped. "Tell me what happened, Kathy." His voice was thin, exhausted. I could still hear the murmur of the Baranis in another room. "Do they know you just walked into their house?" "Their house?" He looked behind him at the door, then down at the carpet. There was a piece of paper there, and he picked it up, unfolded it, and handed it to me. I read it, my face turning hot, my stomach cold and hollow. "They're in the bathroom?" He nodded. I thought of the colonel's wife bringing me tea and fruit, her lined, beautiful face giving me all her attention. "Shit." "Yep." He took the note from me, folded it tightly, and stuffed it into his front jeans pocket. "I waited for you at the camp, but when you didn't show up, I went looking for you and ended up here. I looked through the window and saw my gun on the counter, and you weren't anywhere, so I guess I just feared the worst." He kept his eyes on me a second, then looked away. He told me how he heard me moan, how he'd kicked in the back door and grabbed his gun, then saw me on the floor, and as he said all this, his voice steady, my head started to feel too heavy for my neck. Now Les was using legal language about what he'd done. B&E, brandishing a weapon, false imprisonment, all the real trouble he could be in. He sat in the chair with his elbows on the armrests, his shoulders hunched, his long fingers hanging there. I said, I didn't think you'd come back. Why, Kathy? Why do you think that? He leaned forward and rested his hands on my knees. I don't know. I looked down at his arms, a long blue vein in the belly of his forearm. I told him about yesterday when I started thinking for the first time how much he must love his kids and how they must love him and how bad I felt squeezing myself into that picture. And so I made sort of a vow to myself to try and solve my problems without fucking up anyone else's life. Drove here to talk to the colonel's wife woman to woman, but her husband came home and forced me into my car, and as I told Les this, I felt angry again. I kept my eyes on the veins in Lester's arm the whole time I spoke. His foot was bouncing slightly, then it stopped. When did you drink, Kathy? I told him, but I couldn't remember what came first and what came later. I almost didn't tell him about the woman at the gas station, but then I did, and he asked if she got a good look at me, at the plates of my car. I don't know. We were both quiet. He got up and sat on the bed next to me, put his arm around my back. His body odor was strong and his breath was bad, like old coffee, and this made me feel a little better, the fact his smell wasn't pure and clean. Then I thought of my own teeth coated with dried stomach acid, and I kept my face down. There was a knocking on the inside of the bathroom door down the hall, the colonel's muffled voice calling Lester, "Sir," asking to be let out so his family could eat. This is crazy, Les. Crazy? He was holding me against him, his voice hot in my ear. What about trying to kill yourself, Kathy? What do we call that? He let go of me and stood, the pistol handle sticking out his waistband. Just tell me this. Was it drinking too much on a really bad day? Or do you really want to die? The colonel knocked on the bathroom door again. I looked back down at the Persian carpet, at all those dark reds and purples. My throat began to close up. I just want things to change. The colonel pounded on the door. It sounded like he was using his fist. You must to allow us food immediately. Lester leaped over to the doorway. You'll eat when you call the goddamn county. Yes. The colonel's voice was low and dulled behind the closed door, but I heard his next words clearly. I will do as you say. We will sell. Lester looked back at me and smiled so wide his mustache went up in a straight black line above his teeth. But I could hardly move. I just sat there, not knowing what I'd just won. I put my hand over my lips, and he walked over and squatted on the floor at my feet. How's that for a change? He shook his head. When I found out what you'd done, I felt stood up. Isn't that strange? What does that say about me? I didn't know what that said about him, but I knew I felt closer to him when he said it. I reached over and took his hand, rubbing my finger over the ridge of his knuckles, down over his wedding band. I don't think I would have done any of this sober or less, if that helps you. It does. The colonel knocked again, this time softly. I'm going to have to keep the heat on them until they go, Kathy. Maybe you should leave until then. I'm staying here. Promise? Les was looking into my face, his dark eyes so warm and full of need I didn't know if I wanted to kiss him or move away. He kissed me, and one of his mustache whiskers went up my nose. I watched him leave the room, pulling out his pistol as he went. I looked around for my clothes, but they weren't anywhere. So I got up, stood in the doorway, and watched Lester set a crowbar against the wall, push open the door, and step back with his gun at his side. At his feet on the rug were two neckties, and he told the Baranis to go into the kitchen. As they came out, I pulled the robe together at my throat. I felt like stepping back into the bedroom and closing the door, but I knew they'd already seen me. Lester walked backwards in front of them, stepping into the doorway beside me to let them by. The colonel went first, then his wife and son, the colonel looking straight ahead as he passed me, his chin high, like he was marching in a military parade. His shirt was wrinkled, and there was a dab of shaving cream just beneath his jawbone. I was impressed by this, the fact he took the time to shave. In looking at him that moment, Lester standing beside me with his gun at his side, I was glad things were turning out this way, that this hot-tempered shithead was almost Middle Eastern history for me. But then his wife glanced at me without turning her head, and I knew she was scared of Lester and was trying to see where I stood in all this. I looked down at the floor in time to see their teenage son's big brown feet. Les nudged my shoulder and nodded for me to go use the bathroom if I needed to. Then he followed the boy into the kitchen, and I shut myself in my old bathroom, locked the door, and peed as quietly as I could. The room smelled like toothpaste and the colonel's shaving cream. My clothes were on the towel shelf across from me, folded in a neat pile against the wall. My shorts, my client's daughter's turquoise t-shirt from Fisherman's Wharf, a corner of her panties and my bra under both. My Reeboks were set on the floor side by side. On the back of the sink was the empty prescription bottle. I didn't remember ever holding it in my own hand, but looking at it, I wasn't filled with the remorse and dread I'd felt before, or even the dark rush I'd try again. I felt thankful, like the contents of that empty brown bottle had turned things around for me like nothing else could have. While I washed my face and hands with hot water and soap, I pictured myself cleaning and returning the girl's t-shirt and underwear later this week. Today was Wednesday, yes, Wednesday, my Coma River morning, when I was supposed to clean her house anyway. But I'd have to call her father at his office and postpone a day or two because I was moving. I was moving back into my house. I took a fresh towel and pat dried my face, breathed in the clean smell of the thick terry cloth. I still wanted to disappear, but not completely. My mouth tasted horrible. I squeezed an inch of toothpaste onto my forefinger and used that, rinsing 6 or 7 times. Then I drank from the faucet. On the towel shelf was the colonel's shaving kit, but nothing of his wife's. No brush or comb, not even a compact. I bent over, letting my hair fall over my head. Then I snapped back up and ran my fingers over my scalp, straightening whatever I found, though I only dared to check myself in the mirror for a second. I slipped out of Mrs. Barani's robe and started to get dressed. I was a little dizzy from trying to fix my hair, and I could hear the clink of silverware out in the kitchen, Lester's voice saying something about a phone book. He was talking louder and faster than he usually did, more jumpy. I knew he'd been up all night, and that he was doing something now that could really go wrong if anyone found out about it, something he never would have done if not for me. But then I remembered his story about planting coke in the wife beater's bathroom, and I felt a little better as I put the t-shirt over my head and caught the faint scent of vomit and gun oil. Me and Lester. I smelled toast. My stomach had never been so empty and flat. A hunger pain turned over behind my ribs. My body felt light, almost pure, but not my head. It was like I had cotton not in my ears, but in my thoughts. A cigarette and some tea, that's all I needed. I folded the towel and put it back on the shelf. I heard silverware tink once against a plate out in the kitchen. The colonel cleared his throat, then spoke into the telephone. There was a pulsing in my hand and fingers, and I opened the door enough to hear him give his full name and my address to somebody on the other end. I stuck my head out the door and looked down the hall, saw their son sitting at the counter hunched over a bowl of cereal. I could see his mother's hands buttering a piece of toast as carefully as if it were something living. The colonel stood against the back wall near 2 or 3 pots of flowers, holding the receiver with 2 hands. I didn't see Lester anywhere, but I pictured him standing in the living room with his gun. And as I left my bathroom, running my fingers back through my hair, I hoped he wasn't pointing it at anyone.
I have followed Burden's orders and completed the telephone call, and I sit upon a stool at the counter with my wife and son and drink black tea that is bitter,
for the samovar has been lighted all the evening long. Burden and his djende sit upon the sofa at our backs, eating our bread, drinking our tea. Through the kitchen's window, beneath the steps of the new widow's walk, the sky is as clear and blue as when flying at high altitudes in air with no clouds. From the woodlands across the street come the morning songs of birds, and far away, perhaps down in the village, a dog barks. It would not serve Burden's purpose to shoot us in the back as we sit, but I have the feeling my backside is not clothed, nor even has the protection of flesh over bone. Nadire has eaten very little of the toast before her, and she drinks her tea without sugar in her mouth. This she does rarely, and I assume it is to avoid the slurping sound it sometimes makes, the pull of air between the sugar and teeth. All the morning long she has been silent, the same quiet bird who clutched our infant son in the middle of the night as our bulletproofed limousine drove through the alleys of the capital city. Once again she has surrendered the burden of action to me, and I am grateful and resentful as well. My son has finished eating, and he sits and waits for what is to happen next. Again this morning, as we took our turn at the sink washing, I told him to do nothing but what Mr. Burden instructs. "Yes, Baba," he said, his eyes upon mine, and in them was a dark, hopeful light that is now a heavy timber across my back, for I have no real plan of any kind. I hear Burden upon the sofa, whispering to Kathy Nicolo. As I spoke on the telephone with the same tax bureaucrat as before, Burden sat upon our sofa's edge, his weapon placed on the cushion beside him, and the voice of the bureaucrat became nearly boyish, unable to conceal his relief at my news of selling back to the county this bungalow. For a brief moment, I felt a measure of his relief, a desire to simply follow his instructions, travel to Redwood City to sign the proper documents releasing a check in my name. Simply do as I am ordered and leave. But ordered by whom? This thin policeman, sick and weak with love? And leave to what place? A hotel that will begin to eat our small nest of money even before we find a new home? One we would surely not be able to buy and sell at 3 times our investment? I drink my bitter tea, the whispering voices of our captors at my back. Many days when I toiled as a garbage soldier under the hot sun or in the cool, wet fog with the old Vietnamese, the fat and lazy Panamanians, the pig Mendez, the Chinese who smoked cigarettes as if it was the air they had imported from their home country, as we fanned out along the roadside with our harpoons in bright yellow plastic bags, I sometimes believed I was being punished for the comfortable life I led as a high officer among beggars. But this belief came only on the worst of days, when my fatigue seemed to come from my own blood. Most days, however, I believed I was being tested by my God, and that if I possessed a true desire to escape that life, I must have patience and continue to endure until my opportunity revealed itself. This armed couple in our home is nothing more than a test within a test, something that comes when the prize is quite close at hand. Again, I must simply bow my head and wait. An automobile drives past the bungalow, and someone rises from the sofa. There is the soft rustle of the drapery at the window, the footsteps over the carpet to the countertop, and the telephone at my left. It is Burden, the grip of his weapon protruding from the front of his trousers. He regards us all as he presses the receiver's buttons. He is perhaps 20 years my junior, but my veins speed at the thought of grasping the gun from his pants. Have I grown too slow? If I must ask, it is already too late. I breathe quietly, turn away from Mr. Burden, and look over Nadi at a smile, who regards me, then Burden's weapon, then me once again, his face still, his eyes bright. On the telephone, Lester V. Burden identifies himself as a deputy and requests information on any dispatch of a weapon being brandished in San Bruno yesterday, a self-service benzene station off the King's Highway. He is silent for a long moment, and I do not know if he is watching us or his woman. He speaks again. Was there a vehicle ID on that? Burden thanks his colleague and hangs up the telephone. He does not move, and I regard him evenly. His eyes are small and moist with fatigue. It is clear he has not slept, but I do not know if this will be to my advantage or not. You and your son are coming with me. Get cleaned up. We have a lot to do. Lester allowed the colonel and the boy to go into their rooms one at a time for fresh clothes, then ordered them into the bathroom together to change. He stood in the dim hallway and waited, holding the pistol down at his leg. And even though it was on double safety, he wished it wasn't part of the equation at all. But what was the equation? He wasn't sure. All he knew was they had a perp and vehicle description on Kathy, but no plates, and his appointment with Alvarez had gone better than he had honestly expected. Lester had sat in a steel chair in front of the lieutenant's desk and told him most of the truth of Monday night, that he'd gone to the Corona address on behalf of a friend and simply suggested to Mr. Berani that he do the right thing and move. He had never made any threats of any kind, was just trying to act as an intermediary in a dispute. Unfortunately, he had told the lieutenant, I made the mistake of leaving my uniform on. I know now that was highly inappropriate. He says you threatened to have his family deported. Lester smiled and shook his head. I'm not INS. Maybe Alvarez had had an especially good run this morning, or maybe the sight of Lester's still damp hair, nicked face, and wrinkled pants kept bringing the lieutenant back to Lester's phone message about family troubles. Alvarez sat back in the upholstered chair behind his desk, his elbows on the arms, the tips of all 10 fingers touching. Are you and your wife getting counseling? Yes. This was a lie Lester hadn't planned on, but it came out so naturally, he had to wonder if he was getting help. The lieutenant looked at him for a long 5 seconds. Then he sat forward and picked a pin up off his blotter. You're an FTO deputy. I shouldn't have to tell you squat about departmental code. Yes, sir. The lieutenant tapped his pen once in his open palm. Then he stood, and so did Lester. Consider this an oral reprimand to get back in line. And next time I ask you to my office, I don't care if there's a death in the family. I want you in that chair. Understood? Yes, sir. You have a bright future here, deputy. I highly recommend you don't shit where you eat. Good day. On the other side of the bathroom door, the colonel was speaking low in Farsi to his teenage son. But the son was quiet, and Lester wondered if he was scared. The colonel certainly didn't sound scared. Was he feeling resigned to this new situation? That he would just have to reverse the house sale and that was that? Lester didn't think so. He remembered the colonel's face after he'd pulled the gun barrel from under his chin, his narrowed eyes, his lips a straight line. Now Lester wiped the sweat from his forehead, tried to breathe deeply through his nose, but the air wasn't coming fast enough. This was crazy. Berani was too proud to take defeat so passively. Was he playing possum? Was he just biding his time until he and his family were free of Lester and his gun? And when would that be? After this little house was empty of their things, and they got about 4 blocks down the road in their U-Haul to a payphone to call Alvarez in Redwood City? The colonel's wife was washing dishes quietly in a sink full of water. Lester could smell Kathy's cigarette smoke, and he thought he could get away with leaving Mrs. Berani alone for a minute or two. He called Kathy's name and heard her get off the couch immediately. He didn't know how she would take what he was about to tell her, but he began by pulling the loaded magazine from the pistol and thumbing each 9mm round into the palm of his hand. She came up to his side, her hair a little wild, her face shadowed, and he kissed her quickly on the lips, tasting tea and nicotine, then took her hand and placed the bullets in it. One fell to the carpet, and he stooped quickly and put it back in her palm. He whispered,
"We have to bail out of this."
Kathy looked at him and shook her head, her eyes dark and moist, her lips parted like there was something she'd been prepared to say but now forgot what it was.
"This prick's not going to let this all slide, Kath. As soon as we send him packing, he'll make his move."
"What do you mean? Let him keep the house?"
Lester could see her heart beating in her jugular vein.
"No, you need to sell him this house. Take the money he gave the county and let him do whatever he wants with this little place."
"It was my father's, Les."
A tear edged itself out her right eye, and Lester thumbed it away. He closed his eyes and breathed deeply through his nose. He was about to say he was sorry. He'd lost his temper and fucked up. But the bathroom door opened, and the colonel and boy came out. The colonel in dress pants, white shirt and silk tie, the boy in basketball shoes, bright green surfer shorts, and a tank top. Lester could smell the colonel's cologne, something sweet and European. He stepped with Kathy into the doorway of the boy's bedroom and waved his gun at them to move into the kitchen. He felt Kathy standing squarely behind him out of sight, sniffling and sticking the bullets into her shorts pockets. When the two Biranis reached the kitchen counter, their backs to the hallway, Lester told them to stay right there. The boy was taller than the father, and he was looking in the direction of his mother at the sink. Lester leaned back against the door casing so he could still see them, but Kathy too. She was looking at him, her eyes welling up.
"This is my fault. I didn't mean for you to get into this."
Lester thought how it was true they wouldn't be here now if she had only met him last night at the fish camp, if she had gone there, drunk or sober, instead of here with his gun. But he could feel the Biranis waiting, and this wasn't the time. They would have to talk later. He whispered,
"I know you didn't. Listen, take his money, and he'll still have his real estate, and then maybe I can convince him to keep things between us."
Kathy wiped her nose and shook her head.
"It won't work. You haven't seen his temper."
Lester looked at the father and son. The boy had crossed his arms across his chest, and the colonel was resting one hand on the countertop as if he were close to losing his patience. A warm flash passed through Lester's face and neck, and his mouth went dry.
She was right. Even if Biranis agreed to this sudden change in plan, they couldn't be sure he wouldn't turn on them anywhere along the line out of vengeance, the house in his hands or not.
He felt Kathy's fingers on his arm. "We have to get away, don't we?"
Lester nodded. But what were they going to do? Just drive away from here and keep driving? And in what? His Toyota and Kathy's wanted car? Or would they have to leave Kathy's car behind? Airports would be put under surveillance. So would all the bus and train stations. They would have to disguise themselves, rent a car under false names, and make their way north or south to the border. Lester's mouth tasted like metal. His legs seemed to have disappeared, and he was adrift in cold, black space. How and when would he be able to see Bethany and Nate again? To hold them. Kiss them. But what was the alternative? Criminal charges? Prison?
"We're going to need that money, Kathy." She looked down the hallway, then closed her eyes and shook her head.
"I didn't want you to fall into my shit, Les. I really didn't."
"Hey," he said, kissing her quickly on the cheeks and lips, "your shit's my shit. Think of someplace sunny we can go."
The keys were still in Kathy's Bonneville, and Lester had the colonel and boy sit in the front while he sat in back. The upholstery was already warm from the sun, and the inside of the car smelled faintly of gasoline and Kathy's cigarette smoke. At Lester's feet was an empty Bacardi rum nip. He told the colonel to start the car and drive it over the lawn and around to the rear of the house. Biranis paused before putting the car in gear. The son glanced at his father, then looked away, and Lester leaned forward and pressed the gun barrel to the back of the colonel's neck. The boy seemed to stiffen in the passenger seat, and Lester felt bad about that, but not enough to pull the gun away. The colonel drove slowly around to the back of the house. There were beads of sweat on his bald head. One dripped into another and caused a rivulet to run into the old officer's thinning black and gray hair. "Pull right up to the hedge and give me the keys." Lester turned to the son,
who was looking straight ahead through the windshield, as if they were on the open road. The boy's sideburns were soft, downy hairs. "Ismail, am I pronouncing your name correctly?" The boy nodded once. "Good. Now I want you to listen to me, Ismail. Last night you did something that got your family locked into the bathroom, and right now we're going for a ride to Redwood City, and I want you along for company. Look at me, please." The boy did, and Lester pressed the barrel a bit deeper into the colonel's neck. "Men learn from their mistakes," Ismail. "And you don't want consequences to get any worse, do you?" Ismail shook his head, his eyes on the trigger finger of Lester's hand. "Good boy." Lester got out of the car and stuck his weapon into the waistband of his pants, covering it with his shirt. The sky was a bright gray haze that made him squint, and he had the colonel walk first, then the boy. The inside of the colonel's Buick was as clean as a model right off the lot, and Lester sat in the back, directly behind Ismail in the passenger seat, and stretched his leg out on the gray fabric. When the colonel started the engine, Lester pressed the window button for some air, held his pistol in his lap, and told the colonel to drive down the hill and take Hillside Boulevard for El Camino Real South. Lester's mouth was dry from the black Persian tea and no sleep, and he wanted a cold Coke, though he knew he didn't need the sugar or caffeine. It was as if he was in a downward rush off a mountain, a fine electric current running from his feet to his brain, and the feeling wouldn't stop until he landed on solid ground. But where would that be? Mexico? Driving south through Chula Vista and the neighborhoods of his youth to the same border post his father had worked? No. They would drive north to Vancouver or British Columbia, where he'd heard there were mountains along the coast. He and Kathy could get lost in them, find a cabin where they'd spend the morning and early afternoons in bed, getting up to shower together, then dress, and go into one of those seaside towns in search of a long, hot meal. Lester felt Bethany and Nate standing outside this picture, and he tried to swallow but couldn't. And would it be that easy anyway? Did the United States have an extradition treaty with Canada? Would they have to lie low there too? Lester didn't know. He would have to find out. At the bottom of the hill, the colonel stopped at the intersection before the main drag through downtown Corona. Across the street was a black and white from the city parked against the curb, and Lester recognized the young cop behind the wheel. His name was Cutler. One night last spring, Lester had given him cross-jurisdictional backup for a jeep full of drunk fraternity boys from San Francisco State. Now he glanced over at the colonel's Buick, just as it took the left for Hillside, and Lester slowly turned his face away, kept his eyes on the colonel's profile as he drove them up into the hill past pure stands of ponderosa pine broken up by the trimmed lawns of homes with seaside views from their second-story decks. The sky was still gray, and it made the grass appear a heightened green, not quite natural. The colonel was driving with both hands on the wheel, checking the rearview mirror every few seconds. Lester turned and saw three or four cars on the incline behind them, and he leaned back and told the colonel in a calm and relaxed voice to speed up a bit. The colonel obeyed instantly. Was he still playing possum? Or was he truly deep under Lester's thumb? Deep enough he would stay quiet after this was all through. Lester felt a rise of hope in him. Maybe there was still a way to work this out. He took his service pistol and slid it beneath his leg. "We need to talk, Colonel." Barani's eyes darted to the rear view, and Lester saw new fear in them, that and a hardness, one he would have to start softening right now. "How much did you pay for the house?"
$45,000.
Lester looked down at his hands, his long, thin fingers, the fingers of a woman. He knew an auction price would be low, but he hadn't expected it to be a third of what the house was worth. He took a half breath and let it out. Why give this dictatorial son of a bitch the best deal? What had he done to deserve it? Why not take his money and the house? But it wasn't what the colonel had done last night, Lester knew. It was what he had done. And Kathy. There was still time to plea bargain. They weren't completely on the run yet. Ms. Nicolo's not a well woman. The colonel's eyes moved to the rearview mirror again, and this time they looked softer, curious. Not about Kathy, probably, but the direction of the conversation, the shift in tone. This was good, Lester thought. Two men talking. You saw that last night, didn't you, Colonel? The boy looked at his father, then straight ahead at the road.
Yes.
What she really needs is rest. Berani looked like he wanted to say something, but was content to wait for hours.
She's had a change of heart about the house.
What does this mean? The colonel glanced back into the mirror. It means you can keep it. Berani's eyebrows went up, two thin snakes springing out of nowhere.
She does not wish the sale to be rescinded?
Yes and no. Only she wants to be included in the transaction this time. No county, just a private deal.
I do not understand.
Between the two of you, you take the county check and sign it over to her. When the county returns ownership to Kathy, she'll just let you keep it and she gets some rest. They were entering a small business district, passing a clothing boutique, a golf supply outlet, and a video store and sandwich shop. Berani's eyes were back on the road, his face expressionless.
She will produce the proper paperwork for this amount? It will be in writing the bungalow belongs to me?
Yes. Up ahead was the turnoff for Skyline Boulevard and the Junipero Serra Freeway. Lester usually took El Camino Real, but the freeway would get them there faster.
Are we agreed, Colonel?
Berani glanced into the rearview.
Once the county bureaucrats have written the property in my name, I will give to her the money.
Lester took a deep chest-wavering breath and let it out.
That could take days.
Take the Skyline, please. The colonel took the turn slowly. He had just agreed to sign over the check, but why the somber, doubtful tone in his voice? It was the circumstances under which all this was happening. Lester was sure of it. It was the colonel's pride. Lester thought that maybe he should apologize, just explain that he hadn't known what had happened to Kathy, that he'd overreacted and now would like to put it all behind them if he could. But then he would be offering the captive colonel his bare throat, and a new fear was beginning to move coolly through Lester's ribcage. The county tax office was 50 yards from the Hall of Justice building in Redwood City, so he would have to let the colonel go in alone and hope he was sold enough on this new proposition just to sign his papers and leave without an extra word to anyone. And what about the boy? If Lester let him go with his father, then Lester would be a lone target on a shelf if Berani concluded he was better off calling in the wolves than keeping his end of the agreement. And what was in it for Berani to stay in the deal? He already owned the house. All he would be getting in return is what he already had, that and Kathy and Lester off his back, which he could also get if he called the department from the county tax office and a half dozen deputies descended on Lester sitting in the colonel's Regal. No, Lester thought. This was no time for false hopes. The thing to work on was getting back to Corona with the county check, then taking a reading on things from there. And he was going to have to reconsider the tone of this whole exchange. The only thing Lester still had going for him was the fact he had lost his temper last night, that he was still armed, and for all practical purposes was moving the colonel and son against their will, and they still did not know what he was capable of, which meant Lester was going to have to keep the boy in the car with him once they got to Redwood City. Keep the boy as some kind of human collateral, a thought that sent a twinge through Lester's shoulder and neck. He rotated his head once, but his muscles were too tight for anything to crack. He looked out the window. Skyline Boulevard ran along the spine of hills that divided the ocean side of the peninsula from the bay, and when he first began to patrol this territory, Lester had been taken by the absolute contrast in vegetation on either side. The land to the west, from the hills to the beaches of the Pacific, was locked in fog and rain, and so was thick with forests of live oak, digger pine, madrone, and Douglas fir. And south of Half Moon Bay, the farmland was planted right to the shore. Wide open artichoke fields that were such a sustained green, Lester found it almost too much to take in while driving. Lawns came in thick and coarse, but green. But in towns to the east, from San Bruno to Palo Alto, the grass looked parched and yellowed. Even the watered grounds of estates in Woodside didn't have quite the same chlorophyll-rich look as those to the west. Lester's own lawn in Millbrae was too dry and coarse to sit on without a chair, and it was yellow at the roots. Instead of tall evergreens, the bayside towns were filled with dry shrub of manzanita, pinyon, and toyon, plant life that did well in eroded soil. Soon they were on the freeway, and the colonel was driving at a normal speed. An 18-wheeler began to pass on the left, and Lester could see only the spinning chrome of its wheels through the window. He lowered the pistol between his knees and placed it on the floor at his feet. On their left was San Andreas Lake, the start of the fish and game refuge, the water catching the bright gray of the sky. Lester closed his eyes to it a moment, but then opened them just as quickly. He still had that hum inside him, and it was not unfamiliar. His limbs felt light, as if vapor moved through them instead of blood, and everything he saw had a new clarity to it. The small dots of lint in the gray fabric of the Buick's headrests. The colonel's profile, whenever he would glance to the left or right. The way Lester could distinguish easily between each eyelash. The boy's hair, as black as a Mexican's, his pink scalp barely visible between thick strands, just the hint of smooth brown pigment. It was adrenaline, but more. It was adrenaline that had stopped coming in amateurish gushes and instead shifted into a slow feed, the whole body on a sort of molecular alert. Lester had known this feeling from the births of both his children. He'd known it with varying degrees in his work. And now it seemed to come with the territory of leaving one's wife. With stepping so far over the line to do it, Lester felt sure he was about to come up with a pan full of gold or else get swept down the river altogether. And you couldn't really call it a bad feeling. It occurred to him now it was probably how felons wanted to feel all the time. The sun had burned through the cloud bank and was warm on his skin through the glass. He was thirsty and wanted a bottle of cold spring water, but he couldn't send the colonel or boy into a store to get some, and he couldn't chance all three of them going in either. In the lane in front of them was a municipal van full of Chicano kids, 10 or 11 years old. Most seemed to be moving about in their seats laughing and shouting at each other. But sitting sideways at the rear window was a teenage boy wearing a white helmet, his mouth open, his chin wet with saliva, and he kept rocking back and forth, looking directly at the Buick, at all three of them, it seemed. The colonel slowly changed lanes to pass, and the boy began to rock faster in his seat, his eyes following the Buick as it began to pull out of his sight, his mouth nothing but a dark, wet hole in his face.
For a long time after Lester left with the colonel and his son, I just stood in the bathroom and listened to Mrs. Barani quietly cleaning up out in the kitchen. I didn't like being left alone with her. I didn't know what I was supposed to do, and I wished I hadn't volunteered to stay. Lester had told me to think of some place sunny we could go to, but all I could think of was my family, my brother Frank, and my mother, their faces when they found out I not only sold Dad's house without telling them, but that all I got was an auction price for it before I fled town to spend it. And then they'd get the whole story. My drinking, the gun, the pills, Lester and the family he took hostage. My brother would roll his eyes at me one last time, then write my name permanently on the expensive side of his internal cost-benefit sheet. My mother would just curse me for good. I felt queasy, like an important organ inside me wasn't attached all the way. My front shorts pockets were heavy with Lester's bullets. Yesterday I was convinced that by this time today he'd be back with his wife and kids, back to his life in Eureka Fields. But instead he ended up committing a string of crimes to sit and watch over me in my drugged sleep while he didn't sleep at all. When he made the colonel park my car out of sight in the backyard, I came into the bedroom and watched from the window as he leaned forward and pushed his unloaded gun into the colonel's neck. Lester got out first, stuffing the gun into his pants and covering it with his shirt, and when the colonel followed, the morning sun in his face, it felt good to see him afraid, see him bullied by someone. Your shit is my shit. But I never wanted this problem solved bad enough to scare a woman as sweet as Mrs. Barani. And what was I supposed to do? Go out there and watch her like a prison guard? But then how could I do anything but help Lester get us out of this trouble, which was really more mine than his? It was quiet out in the kitchen, and I pictured her running down the hill into town to find a cop, tell him everything. Maybe they'd catch Lester on the road, think he was armed when I knew he wasn't. I let out a long, weak breath and stepped fast into the hallway. She was still at the kitchen sink. The breakfast dishes were stacked neatly, and she was just standing there, looking out the window, though there wasn't much to see but the wooden staircase up to the new roof deck that was hers now. I used to like looking out that window while I rinsed a plate or coffee cup, see my small side yard and the drop of the hill into town. Mrs. Barani slowly turned her head and looked at me over her shoulder. It seemed to take her a second or two. Her hair was still flattened a little on one side, and I pictured her sleeping in the bathroom, in the tub, or on the floor. I guess I expected her to look ready to fight me somehow, but instead her lined face seemed pained, her eyes taking me in like she wanted to understand me before it was too late. It was almost my mother's look. "Please, your friend." Her voice was weak, and she looked down and pressed her hand to the side of her head, then took a deep breath and looked back at me. "Will he to hurt my son?" "No, he doesn't want any more trouble, Mrs. Barani. He's just trying to finish all this, I guess." I thought about reaching into my pocket for the bullets. She stood still, looking at me, her hand pressed to the side of her head. I was about to tell her I was selling them the house, but her eyes were almost black, like she was imagining something that really scared her, and I knew what it was. "He has a son of his own, you know." She nodded once and took a breath. Then she closed her eyes and pressed until her fingertips whitened. "Are you all right?"
"Migraine. Please, I must..."
She moved by me, and I watched her walk down the dim hallway as slow and careful as an old lady, one hand in front of her, the other pressed to the left side of her head. She left the bathroom door half open, and I could see her feet and lower legs as she knelt on the floor at the toilet. I felt so strange, like it was almost fate that I walk over and hold her forehead as she retched her small breakfast, then sniffled and let out a long moan. "Are you all right?" She raised her head, her face grayish white.
"I must to medicine."
On the sink was the brown vial I'd emptied the night before, and my face flushed as I opened her medicine cabinet, thinking, "Please, please don't be that one." But there were only vials with that snake alphabet on them, and I wouldn't know which one she needed even if I could read them. I picked up the empty vial on the sink and turned around, but Mrs. Barani was up and halfway out the door.
"I'm sorry, Mrs. Barani. I'll drive downtown and buy you some right now. I'm really sorry."
I saw myself getting pulled over in the car, arrested for yesterday's slip over the edge at the gas station, never getting back here to relieve Mrs. Barani's agony. I would have to walk or run down the hill into town, or maybe their son had a bike. But could she be faking all this to get me out of the house so she could call the police? No, she looked too terrible. She was dragging her fingertips along the wall. Then she was in her bedroom, and so was I, watching her sit on the bed and pull open the nightstand drawer, take out a prescription bottle. I was so relieved I hadn't robbed her of what she needed right now. I felt almost cheerful. She dropped her chin as she tried to get the lid off, but couldn't, and I took it from her hands and opened it. There was half a cup of cold black tea near the lamp, Lester's, I guessed, and Mrs. Barani shook out two capsules, palmed them into her mouth, then drank the rest of the tea. She pressed her fingers to